Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here. In fact, I'm just coming from the Silicon Valley and New York City, skipping a conference in Rome to be here with you, because I think you've done a great job and you can do more. You can actually improve the state of the world. We just had a great hackathon, by the way, in San Francisco about earthquake resilience. So we were really astonished how many ideas were basically put into practice within just a few hours, and we have created a new community over there. So why do I think that we can change the world? Well, Instagram had about 13 people, WhatsApp had about 50, OpenStreetMap has 1.5 million active supporters. So you can really change the world. We don't have to wait for politics. We don't have for companies to do that. We can do that ourselves. But here is actually a representation of OpenStreetMap developed over time, and this is so impressive. As you can see over here, within just a few years, you have mapped out the world, and now let's change it to the better. So, of course, it's important to understand how we can improve the world, and complexity science can actually help us with that. What are the problems that we need to address? Well, these are the old problems, natural disasters of all kinds. But in fact, we're facing a set of new problems, systemic instabilities such as financial and economic crisis, social and political instabilities, environmental change, organized crime, also the quick spreading of diseases, and these are all global problems, so we need to address them globally together. And so how do these problems come about? Let us first hear two quotes of colleagues from the United States, two very famous people, Sandy Pendland from MIT. He said, "Our financial, transportation, health system are broken." And Geoffrey West, the former president of the Santa Fe Institute, said, "We're seeing an extraordinary failure of our current political and economic system." And of course, he was referring to the financial crisis at that time. Now, these kinds of problems are very costly, actually, for our society. And so we can do a better job, I believe, using science and combining it with data. One of the sources of the problems that we're having is unstable dynamics in complex systems. And here is an example on the left, how things work well. People are self-organizing into streams of uniform walking direction. It means the opposite flows are separated from each other, which creates efficient flows. And you could compare that somehow with Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. So a self-organized order happens like magic by itself, and people are not even aware of it. But sometimes, if the density is too high, social order breaks down, as it happened, for example, during the Loughborough disaster in Duisburg and in many other crowd disasters. So we need to understand these kind of phenomena. And let's have a look at this problem over here. It shouldn't be difficult to drive in a circle, actually. But it turns out that after a short time, we'll face a phantom traffic jam. And it's happening right now. You can see this traffic jam is moving backward as we know it. And we'll not get rid of this traffic jam anymore. So the question is, why is that happening? And if you would ask drivers, they would probably say, well, there was a stupid driver in front of me who didn't know how to drive a car. But having been a traffic scientist, and actually one of the most cited ones, we know that the phenomenon is a different one. We call the phenomenon that's behind this systemic instability. And so when the density exceeds a certain threshold, or the distances become too small, the slightest variability in the speeds will be amplified, because the next car will have to respond to that, but it responds with a delay, and in order to compensate for that, the driver will tip the brake a little bit harder, and the next one even harder and even harder. So we have a chain reaction that finally leads to an undesirable state. So even though everyone is well-skilled, has good technology, all the information that it seems to take, and the very best intentions to avoid such a traffic jam from happening, it does happen sooner or later if you're in these kind of density conditions. And unfortunately, similar things apply to other kinds of systems. So, for example, in many networks, we find cascade effects. And a single local perturbation can actually mess up the entire system. There should be some noise, actually. But it's not so important to understand this experiment. It shows table tennis balls which are on top of mouse traps. And as you can see over here, a single local perturbation can mess up the entire world. Well, this is an experiment made to show chain reactions as we know them from nuclear reactions. So, for example, nuclear power stations, we know that these chain reactions are controllable, but we also know that sometimes they're getting out of control, as Chernobyl or Fukushima have shown. So we need to take these chain reactions very serious. And here is actually a real life example where you see bankruptcies of banks in the aftermath of the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. So over time, actually hundreds of banks are failing. And now it's not a funny experiment anymore. It's really very sad because it destroys hundreds of billions of dollars that actually we taxpayers probably in one way or another have to pay for. So these kinds of chain reactions can be very expensive and certainly not desirable at all. Things get even worse if we have interdependencies between different kinds of systems, so-called networks of networks. And the World Economic Forum and other institutions have looked at that, and it turns out that more or less all the systems today are interconnected. And that creates a high level of vulnerability in principle. It also turns out that the biggest risks that we have today are of social or economic nature. So we cannot just accept the existence of these risks. We have to do something. So we need to better prepare ourselves, and in particular for the digital revolution to come, because that puts additional stress on the system. Look at this graph that you know from Ray Kurzweil's file, and it basically says that in about 10 to 15 years, computers will reach the processing capacity of the human brain. Now, that has very serious implications because that will have really serious impacts on our economy and our society, because computers will be able to do many jobs that people are doing today, and maybe better. In particular, all the procedural jobs, and we know computers are already better than the best chess players in the world. And they're also better than actually the best people in game shows where difficult questions are being asked. So IBM Watson has won this competition over here, and IBM is just investing $1 billion in order to get this system to the markets. And so we need to be aware that basically we're entering a new era of history of humankind. We've started off with an agricultural society. We see that the number of jobs in the agricultural sector has dropped dramatically. And that's partly related, of course, to the Industrial Revolution after the steam engine was invented. So jobs were created over there, but they're now also going down already. And that's because of automation, it's because of robots being used and so on. And there's the service sector related to the service society, which has produced also additional jobs. However, if we are considering a fourth sector coming up, which is that of information and knowledge production, digital economy somehow, then basically this sector is saturating and is going into a phase where also jobs will go down. And that will trouble our economy and, of course, our society as well. And I think many countries are seeing that already. And the recent taxi strikes against Uber show that we are just in the middle of this transition. So how to fix these problems? Well, data certainty is something that can help us. There are now so much more data than before. And the question is, how can we use them? So certainly we can take better decisions, we can take evidence-based decisions, but I personally think big data is not the ultimate solution. It's particularly no general, no universal solution. And it will become clear by looking at these plots over here. So computer power is doubling every 18 months. This is shown in blue. Then data stored is increasing even more quickly. Every year, basically, it's doubling. And we are already in a situation where within a year, we're producing as much data as in about 2,000 years of human history. So there is a big data tsunami coming over us. However, there's a third curve over here. As we go on networking our world, the number of possibilities is increasing in a combinatorial way. And that means this is really exceeding anything that we'll be able to manage centrally by computation and data analytics. So basically, what that means is we're heading from a situation where we didn't have enough data to take good decisions into a situation where you can take the evidence-based decision-making, and you see it all over the world. Governments are investing into big data, and some people are concerned about it, and including myself. And however, sooner or later, I believe, because of this explosion of complexity that relates to the industrial differentiation and cultural evolution, we'll get into a situation where we see a loss of top-down control. And that means we require an entire different approach to basically steer the world. We need to go towards more autonomy in order to reach our goals as the complexity goes up. And here is an example to illustrate that. It means more bottom-up. And while, for example, disaster response management used to be quite hierarchical in the past, so somebody said, okay, you do this, and those people say, okay, you do this, you do that, and so on and so on. I think we're getting to a situation where the government says, okay, we need water, we need sand, we need vehicles, we need food, and so on. And then from the bottom up, people and companies and NGOs and so on will say, okay, I can do this, we can do that. And so it requires information platform for these things to find together. Now, given that our world is all the time changing more quickly, actually business and politics become more and more like disaster response management. Once one problem is solved, there are already two new problems. So basically, that means we really have to turn into this new kind of approach. And in fact, it is happening already because it's more efficient. We know that not just from our really very impressive immune system, which is not centrally controlled, it's very decentrally organized, and it protects us actually for about a century. Although we are bombarded by millions of bacteria and viruses every day, this is extremely impressive. So it's really a success principle. But we also see that we have more self-controlled approaches in traffic flows based on, for example, inter-vehicle communication. We see that peer-to-peer money is coming up. It's actually becoming more valuable than gold. We see peer-to-peer lending, and taxi stands are being replaced by Uber in many places, and intelligent robots by intelligent swarms, and so on. So basically, something is happening here because it's enabled by a new kind of technology. And maybe the dream to create self-regulating systems from the bottom up based on self-organization can work out. It's already 300 years old. So far, it didn't work. But this is one of the famous books about this, actually 1714, so it's exactly 300 years. And of course, we know it from Adam Smith, The Invisible Hand. Unfortunately, as we know, it often failed to do a good job. The financial crisis is not just the only example for this. For example, we also have environmental exploitation and pollution and other kinds of so-called public goods games or tragedies of the commons, where it would be good for everyone to be cooperative, but these social dilemma situations are situations where everyone is kind of tempted to give a little bit less than the others and take out a little bit more than the others. And that destabilizes this desirable state of cooperation. And it breaks down as the free traffic flow in the circle broke down. It's the same kind of systemic instability. And so the question is, can we come up with mechanisms to stabilize this desirable cooperative solution, and avoid overfishing, climate change, and so on? In fact, I would like to say that now, 300 years later, by combining complexity science and real-time feedback enabled by the Internet of Things, we can now create self-regulating systems and finally make the invisible hand work. So we're now talking more and more about the Internet of Things, and I believe many of the applications that you can read about are almost free of fantasy. In fact, the real potential is in enabling self-regulation. And I'd like to remark that actually I'd like to recommend to build the Internet of Things as a citizen web. We shouldn't wait for companies to do it for us or governments to do it for us. If we build it locally, it can be controlled by the citizens and we can trust the systems. Here is an example how real-time feedback enabled by real-time information is actually allowing us to overcome previous problems. So at the moment you see the stop-and-go traffic over here, which is annoying us every day. And it's just a simulation of that traffic situation as we know it. I will turn this car now into a helicopter, and that will allow us actually to see what's the reason for this annoying stop-and-go traffic. And it turns out, oh, there's a on-ramp over there. A few cars want to get into the freeway. That produces small perturbations. And those perturbations are amplified, cause the stop-and-go traffic. But now we equip the cars with radar sensors that measure the distances and relative velocities. And they will now automatically drive based on this information and will slightly change the interaction mechanism. We call that mechanism design. And what you can see is now suddenly the traffic jam has disappeared. So we can overcome previous problems. We can fix previous instabilities with this new feedback approach. Now, the interesting point is this self-regulation is resource efficient and it's resilient to perturbation. So let us compare a number of different organizational approaches. Classical is top-down regulation. We have a traffic center. It's collecting information from all over the city, trying to optimize the traffic light control and then implements that on the entire city like a benevolent dictator. Then let's take the other approach that we believe to have in many markets. Homo economicus is taking local decisions, trying to do the best thing locally. I mean, here is each intersection trying to strictly minimize travel time separately from the others, not looking what the others are doing. And then there is a third approach that does the same thing, but looks at the impact on the neighboring intersections. When a traffic jam grows large, it will be cleared first. And so that avoids spillover effects. Let's have a look at what the implications of these are. So this is the capacity utilization of an intersection and the queue length of vehicles that results. We can see the top-down regulation is actually producing increasing queue lengths as the capacity utilization increases, and that's logical. So that's our reference, basically. So can the Homo economicus solution, where each single intersection strictly minimizes travel times, perform better? And in fact, it's much better here, so much shorter queue lengths. So we could say the invisible hand works. There is a self-organized coordination and produces really fantastic outcomes. But what's happening here? Suddenly the curve is exploding, queue lengths are becoming enormous, and so that means that the invisible hand suddenly fails, as we've also seen it in the financial markets. We've pushed it too far. Now, how will these other regarding self-organization work that takes a look at the situation of the neighbors? And what you see over here is, well, that is actually doing a very good job all the way. So if we want to overcome the problems, we need to take into account the externalities that we have on others, in this case, on the neighboring intersections. And that then by self-organization, we find this coordination which extends over larger and larger parts of the city and creates a very positive outcome, as we can see over here. So that's good, actually, for public transport, for individualized traffic and pedestrians and cyclists, and by the way, also for our environment. So what are we waiting for? So basically, that means to go away from this over-regulation approach where we're trying to say every company, every individual, what exactly we have to do at what time. And it's a burden, actually, towards a situation where we build infrastructures that enable people to do a good job. And of course, I'm in perspective talking about information infrastructures to allow people to take better decisions and more effective actions. And you can see self-organization can work perfectly if we have the right kind of design. In this case, there is a unidirectional flow here, a unidirectional flow over there, and a buffer in the middle that allows everyone to adjust the speed a little bit, so you would find a gap in the flow and wouldn't have to stop to cross it. So the question is, can we extend this principle from traffic or production, technical systems, to our society and our economy? And in fact, at latest, since Nobel Prize winner Elinor Ostrom, we know this. She has done real life studies, and she has found that given the right design and interaction principles in societies, that will lead to efficient self-governance. So what are we waiting for? And what do we need to do? That's kind of the question. So we can actually be confronted with four kinds of situations when we interact with others. We could have a situation where the interaction is bad for both sides, so that should be avoided. It could be a situation where it's bad for one side and good for the other, but altogether it's bad. So that should also be avoided, but in particular, one person needs to be protected, or one company needs to be protected from the exploitation by the other side that would make a profit. Then you could have a win-win situation. That's good, so we should engage into this interaction. We might further improve the fairness if you want. And we could have good win-lose situations where one would win, the other lose, but altogether there is a positive balance. So if we have an exchange of value, it becomes good for both sides. And we could build these kind of information technologies to help people to engage into better kinds of interactions. So it's again mechanism design. And the four technologies that I've been thinking about to reach this goal is the social mirror, to create context awareness, then the social adapter to facilitate more profitable interactions, understand each other better, then the social protector is there to avoid lossful interactions, and social money to allow for value exchange. And so one of the problems why we often engage into actions that are not good for the world is that we didn't know before that it would be bad. So greater awareness can help. And that, of course, requires information. So here are a number of proposals I'd like to make to the OpenStreetMap community. We could build other open maps, such as open environmental maps, open ecosystem maps, and I would map the changes of our environment and who causes it. We could create open resource maps. That means map the resources in the world and who uses them. And actually, that would have been good for us. We did a study about the resilience of the European gas supply network, but it took us about 2 years to collect all the data. We also did another study on the spreading of the EHEC epidemic, and it required logistic data, which we didn't have at that time. So having that data would be very valuable. We could also engage into open financial risk maps in real time to allow people to do better investments. And we could also map social capital such as trust, solidarity, compliance, reputation, and so on, in order to protect it better, because that is actually a precondition for a resilient society, for economic well-being, and for the happiness of people. We can also map out conflicts and how they come about. And a lot of this can be done with data that are already out on the web. And we can, of course, as you're already doing it, come up with risk maps and crisis maps. The question is whether those should be open or to what extent, because such kind of data could also be misused, so we need to be careful. We should also engage actually in mapping out culture. If you come to another country, it turns out there's a different culture. I mean, different expectations regarding your behavior, different social norms, but nobody can explain it well to you. So you will do a lot of mistakes, and that creates a lot of trouble between people. So over so many thousand years of history, we haven't actually been able to map out this knowledge about our culture. We haven't preserved it in books or in databases. We haven't understood it well. And I think it's really important for us to get along well in a globalized society. So let's try to do that, to help people orient themselves. And this way we could build this social adapter or intercultural adapter that allows us to understand each other better and allows us to engage into more successful interactions across different cultures. Now, we can also build instruments to explore and improve the world beyond what I've already said. And Futurize ID has made a number of proposals. That's a large global initiative, by far not as large as OpenStreetMap, but hopefully, you know, some of you will get excited about, you know, teaming up with us. And so one of these is the digital nervous system, which would be there to create the data for the real-time feedback. One of them is to create interactive virtual worlds in order to have opportunities to test new social and economic mechanisms. Then we would have reputation systems for user-centric quality and reward mechanisms, and finally participatory platforms for crowdsourcing, co-creation, and self-regulation. And how would it work? So the digital nervous system would create tailored measurements better than data mining and machine learning based on big data. And it would be done basically by using sensor networks, as they are now becoming available through the Internet of Things. And actually using smartphones would be one way of doing that, and I will go a little bit into this. What is important for us, though, that we respect privacy of people and that there is informed consent, so they're in control of what happens with their data. And so, that is a first step. We've built Living Archive, which is basically something like a mini Google, a search engine for open data sets. There is also at GitHub, so if you could help to improve it further, people would certainly be very grateful. Now we're in the first steps of creating this digital nervous system. We call it Nervous. It's also at GitHub. And of course, it's inspired by the fact that now the many neurons in our brain, each of which is not intelligent actually, by their interactions creating really astonishing outcomes and a high level intelligence. So if we had many smartphones or even many people interact in such a way, couldn't we create something like awareness and collective intelligence? Okay, so let's take the sensors of our smartphones, and how could we use that to make measurements such as, you know, where have been earthquakes recently, or where are people getting up early, or where are the road bumps in Zurich, to mention just three questions. And we're working at the moment with Android, and we are reading out some of the sensors. For example, the accelerometer data. And the idea is that in this way, we could in fact determine road bumps, because in our many smartphones do this in the same place, that means there is a road bump. And similarly, we could use that for collective earthquake sensing and warning. So these are just two examples of collective measurements where we don't need to look into any private activity in order to understand these kind of things, because we are averaging over many data here, and as I said, people would do that on their own decisions. So here is the GitHub repository, and if that is exciting for you, please join in, help us come up with ideas, also thinking about 3D photography and printing, and of course bug reports and so on. So next thing, the interactive virtual worlds. So the purpose is not to build a crystal ball, but to make us aware of opportunities and risks and to design better manageable systems. And so basically it would bring together many models that we have today about traffic, production, social systems, and all sorts of things. And actually, we have a course about modeling social systems in MATLAB. There's also a GitHub repository with all the most interesting codes that have been produced. Well, we could actually collect pictures that are out on the web in order to reconstruct the real world in 3D. So that has happened over here. So there have been thousands of photographers, and you can see putting it all together from your desk at home, you can reconstruct the 3D environment, not just the street map. You can reconstruct the entire world to a certain, a very astonishing extent with those data that are already out there. But besides creating a mirror world, we can establish interactive virtual worlds to explore new socioeconomic mechanisms in the world. So we could, for example, look into alternative financial architectures, voting rules, or intellectual property rights settings or privacy settings, and see what happens before we implement these things in the real world. And why should we have a number of virtual parallel worlds, and you would just choose the one that you like? We are now already engaging into using interactive games as experimental platforms And we're working in particular on node gain as a basis for web experiments that's using Amazon Mechanical Turk, for example, to recruit people in order to learn about how people behave in certain kinds of situations in order to come up with better institutions. Now, the reputation systems would be there to create a platform for multi-criteria quality feedback and a multi-dimensional reward system promoting responsible behavior. Now, the interesting thing is that reputation systems can help to overcome the tragedies of the commons that I've mentioned before. So this is very interesting, in particular, as this mechanism works for a globalized world. And in fact, this quick spreading of reputation mechanisms shows us that there must be a benefit of it. In fact, it's now almost everywhere on the web. And actually, studies show it's good for everyone. It's good for the customers because they get a better service. It's also good for the sellers because they can sell their products at a higher price and can sell also higher quality for a good price. So the only problem is that many of the reputation and recommender system we have today are controlled by a company or one instance, and they're kind of one-dimensional. So we're getting into a situation where we can't see the world in an objective way anymore. We're seeing it based on that information that somebody gives to us. So we can be manipulated. And that's not good because it can actually destroy one of the fundamentals of our democracy, which is the wisdom of crowds. So as we are influenced by others, this wisdom is actually undermined. And so we've been working on a social information filtering system, which is user-controlled. For the example of a virtual scientific journal, which basically looks into the ocean of all the publications in science in the world, and you can come up with certain filters yourself that basically creates your own personalized journal. You can share these filters with your colleagues. They could change them, improve them, share them back, and all this. So eventually there would be hundreds or even thousands or millions of information filters, an ecosystem of filters actually. And those which are superior will get to the top and others will disappear. So, like my presentation over here, no idea what happens here. This is kind of a forced ending, huh? Let me see, I'll go a little bit more quickly. Huh? Yeah, we're back, I know. But I'm put under pressure. Now comes the interesting part, about the future economy, so, and the future money, because I believe that we need to have a new financial architecture. And what I've been thinking about is how can we use reputation mechanism, combine them with money to come up with social money, with qualified money that has a memory where it comes basically. And so you can qualify for higher value. But what is more important than this is that we have a multidimensional money, because that is needed for the self-regulation to work well. We need to have a multidimensional reward system, not just the one money that we effectively have today. And then, of course, participation is really key. And why is it so important? Because as the complexity of our system goes up, we need to have more distributed control, as I explained to you before, for the system to work well. And so that basically comes down to create options and opportunities that enable people to take better decisions, more effective actions, and coordinate each other. And actually, the social media are very much doing this. We're using them often for entertainment, but I think that basically the next generation social media will be much more oriented at co-production, co-creation. And it's happening, of course, already, but it's not yet fully there. We don't have yet the infrastructure for the economy 4.0, the digital society that's coming up at the moment. But many things are happening, including 3D printing, which allows us, everyone, basically, to contribute to production. So, yeah, it's kind of peer production in a sense. And some people say we're moving from an age of democratization of consumption to an age of democratization of production. And that requires, of course, trustable information platforms. We need to make sure that our personal data are not stolen, that we have control of the personal data, that we actually benefit from value generated on our personal data. No idea why it's disappearing again, so there's a remote control. I don't want to speculate who has that. So, in principle, I think the approach that solves this is to create a personal data purse, something like a mailbox for personal data, where all the data about you would have to be sent. You could specify who is allowed to use what kind of data for what kind of purpose, and you would be able to get some money for any use of this data. So I'm concluding by saying we need a joint global effort to master the global 21st century challenges and build the framework for the emerging digital society. So let's do that together. Thank you very much.